To begin the afternoon session of the ANS meeting, I'd like to introduce our William House lecturer this year. Dr. Lambert had such a fine introduction from Dr. Jenkins at the close of our last meeting that I don't think I can top that. But let's suffice to say, Dr. Lambert has considerable experience in the arena of both training neurotology fellows as well as examining the educational process and ensuring that that process is done in a reputable manner with his work with the ABO. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Lambert and his lecture on evolution of neurotology training.
Well, thank you, Jeff, very much for your kind introduction, and good afternoon, friends and colleagues. I appreciate Jeff providing lunch for us back there, and in all seriousness, let me congratulate Jeff on just really an outstanding year of leadership for our society. Well, it is a great privilege indeed to be counted among those who have stood in this place, and a distinct honor to pay tribute to Dr. William House, who was a mentor of mine many years ago, many years ago, as this slide attests. Well, here is my obligatory disclosure slide. Well, this history goes back almost five decades to 1963, when these seven individuals held an informal gathering at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Ophthalmology and Otolaryngology in New York City. And as you review those records, it appears that the meeting was prompted by several concerns. First, with the recent introduction of temporal bone tomography and more sophisticated vestibular and audiometric site of lesion testing, the role of the otologist in interpreting these new tests was unclear. Secondly, the best treatment strategies for ear problems now being diagnosed with these new technologies was uncertain. And finally, there was the question of the best format for disseminating new information. To address these questions, this group formed the Neurotology Group and planned to hold a scientific session in 2 years. They accomplished that in 1965 in the basement of the infamous Palmer House with about 100 in attendance. 2 years later, a constitution and bylaws was adopted, and then in 1969, 49 otologists from across the country were invited to become charter members. In 1974, the name was changed to the American Neuro-Otology Society. So in the short span of just a decade, a concept was born and the foundation for our current society was established. Now in the 1980s, medicine was increasingly embracing the concept of subspecialization, and this trend was not lost on the American Board of Otolaryngology, which petitioned the American Board of Medical Specialties for certificates of added qualifications in otology, neurootology, facial plastic and reconstructive surgery, and pediatric otolaryngology. Defining the scope of practice and the specific qualifications for a CAQ were the next steps. For otology and neurootology, the state of training at that time presented a number of challenges. In 1951, the Hausser Institute began offering one-year fellowship programs. And over the next several decades, additional programs developed, many of which could trace their lineage to Bill House. The problem in the 1980s was the rapid proliferation of fellowships, many of which were simply short-term apprenticeships. Training requirements and minimal standards were non-existent. The ANS and the AOS became critical players in developing fellowship guidelines. And in 1989, this committee developed the initial document defining the scope of practice for neurootology and outlining the requirements for a fellowship program. Now, I would be an historical revisionist if I did not tell you that the journey to fellowship accreditation and subspecialty certification was at times divisive and contentious for our society, with several of our leaders, notably Bruce Gantz and Newton Coker, bearing the brunt of this controversy. But finally, in 1995, the ACGME approved a fellowship in otology, neuro-otology, and 2 years later, Iowa and Michigan were the first two programs to receive accreditation by the RRC. In 2002, the American Board of Otolaryngology dropped the otologic reference, recognizing the need to protect the primary certificate. The first certifying examination was held in 2004, and to date, 245 neuro-otologists have been certified. Currently, these are the 17 programs that have been accredited, and you can see the timeline for their approval. Now, these next several slides are interesting, and they are courtesy of Dr. Bruce Gantz, and they show the first group of examinees. This was the morning group, and this was 2004, and the afternoon group, and then this motley collection of examiners, a little darker shade here, I guess, in keeping with their role as inquisitors. Well, today, the accreditation of fellowships and the certification process all appears to be seamless and automated, but it's important to recognize that it took almost 2 decades to transition from concept to reality. And as this slide shows, many organizations were involved and countless hours were expended by many in this society. So let's transition now from the past to the present. What have been some of the tangible results of formalizing our training and certifying graduates? Well, there are many, and they involve the clinical, research, and educational realms. Clinically, this process has produced a cohort of highly trained individuals who have expanded our scope of practice, particularly as it relates to skull-based surgery, and they have established our credibility among other disciplines, particularly neurosurgery. Now, obviously, the field made sentinel advances before formal fellowships, but the increasing complexity of neuro-otology simply demanded something more. Clearly, we have elevated our status within the General House of Medicine. In the area of research, opportunities and productivity has significantly expanded. This relates both to the self-selection process, those willing to spend 2 extra years in training, and to the research requirements written into the training guidelines. Coincident with increased research productivity, the ANS recognized the need to recognize good science. With donor support, the Society established 2 research awards, the Nicholas Torrick Vestibular Award and the Silverstein Award. In the last 20 years, more than $300,000 has been dispersed, and this money appears to have been well spent. Of the 23 recipients of these 2 awards, over 1/3 have subsequently received NIH funding. Now, I realize that one cannot establish a cause and effect, but rewarding research efforts and young investigators certainly sends the correct message. And then finally, I would argue that neuro-otology fellowships have improved the general otologic education in residency programs. Many graduates of fellowships have assumed academic positions and have been able to develop busy otologic practices from which residents have benefited greatly. Well, Bill House is a visionary, and I would be remiss if I did not attempt to look into the future and anticipate issues and questions our specialty must soon confront. And there are 3 areas for us to consider. One is resident tracking, second, manpower requirements, and then practice modifiers. Tracking is not a new concept, and in fact, I remember Howard House discussing this when I was a fellow 3 decades ago, and I'm sure it predated that time period. In 2001, Mike Johns, then president of the American Board of Otolaryngology, wrote an editorial in JAMA about shortening the residency program by emphasizing a more competency-based rather than a strictly time-based training paradigm. In the last 5 years, there's been a definite move by the ACGME and surgical RRCs away from simply counting surgical cases and more towards a competency metric, which is being referred to as the Milestone Project. This shift may very well be a prelude to a serious discussion on tracking. If, for example, residents could demonstrate competency in all the fundamental and key indicator procedures by 4.5 or 4 years, then perhaps the option of a more in-depth experience in a subspecialty for the remaining 6 to 12 months could be considered. Well, what is the level of enthusiasm for that concept? This past September, I sent a 5-question survey to all of the training programs in this country, and one of the questions was simply this: are you in favor of tracking, that is, 4 years of general otolaryngology and then 1 year of a subspecialty focus? And note the rather strong language here of a full year of a subspecialty focus. There was no unanimity on this, but I was somewhat surprised by the significant number of yes responses, 45%. Now, fellowships are directly linked to this discussion on tracking in several ways. First, over the last 10 to 15 years, significantly more and more residents are entering fellowship programs. In fact, all of my residents last 2 years are entering fellowships. The Academy conducts an annual resident survey, and the data from 2011 shows that 70% intend to pursue a fellowship. Interestingly, neurotology was fifth on their list. So given this strong preference for fellowships and the finite number of otologic cases, does it make sense to take a chief resident who is destined for a facial plastic or a rhinology fellowship through a complicated cholesteatoma case or a stapes procedure? Should we instead reserve those cases for those going into general practice or into a neurotology fellowship? If residents entering a fellowship had the opportunity of an enhanced otologic and neuro-otologic experience, they would obviously be better prepared from day one. Because of this minor restructuring of the fellowship, years to include increased time with related disciplines or a full 6 months of research could be implemented. But we must also consider some unintended consequences of tracking, and this is where I have some concerns. I can imagine the following scenario, for example. A third or fourth year resident is interested in otology, but challenged with the decision of an otologic track versus a formal fellowship. The trend towards decreasing numbers of neuro-otologic cases, which I will address in a few moments, coupled with the financial burden of 2 extra years of training, could be powerful incentives to simply gain more experience in otology and then attempt to concentrate on that after graduation. Could the result be a decrease in fellowship applicants? It is a fact that for the vast majority of neurotologists, complex and to some extent even routine otologic cases are necessary to maintain financial viability. Could otologic tracking of residents alter the referral patterns neurotologists depend on? Time doesn't permit the medical, legal, and marketing issues inherent in otologic or any other subspecialty tracking. Well, germane to this discussion is accurate data on current and future manpower requirements in neuro-otology. So returning to that survey, the question was asked whether our output of neuro-otologists is too many, too few, or about right. Well, two-thirds believe that the output was just about right. Our annual output, in fact, averages 11 to 12 per year, and in any 1 year, there are 22 to 25 in training. So what is the job market like for these graduates? Data from this survey suggests that, at least in academic departments, there remains a strong demand. For example, a third of the programs anticipate adding another neuro-otologist in 1 to 2 years and 40% in 3 to 5 years. Although not necessarily related to manpower, but interesting data nonetheless, is this question dealing with the number of neuro-otologists on one's faculty. As you can see, there is a relatively even spread between 1 and 3, although almost two-thirds of the programs had 2 or more neuro-otologists. Now, I would like to acknowledge Jeff Rayback's efforts in beginning to address this issue of manpower. He has performed a preliminary unpublished analysis using the Dartmouth Atlas Healthcare Project and the ANS Registry. The ratio for general otolaryngology has remained the same for a number of years, that is, one general otolaryngologist for 40,000 population. Dr. Rayback's data analysis shows that on average there is one fully employed neuro-otologist for every 1 million population. As would be expected, this distribution is not uniform geographically, with the highest density being in the greater Detroit area with one neurotologist for 360,000 population. This data showed us that for the, largest cities or referral bases with no neurotologists, there were three: Fort Myers, Florida; Fresno, California; and Allentown, Pennsylvania, all with a referral base of over 1 million and no neurootologist. This data will need further refinement, and Jeff's continuing analysis will be necessary before we can answer the basic question of whether or not we are training the correct number of neurootologists. Now, manpower needs will, of course, be significantly influenced by a variety of practice modifiers, some of which we are currently aware of, and then many others that we have yet to anticipate. For example, new or more widely embraced technologies, basic science discoveries, changes in practice patterns or new practice guidelines, or governmental or insurance mandates are just a few of the factors with future implications for our specialty. The influence of technology and practice patterns on vestibular schwannoma surgery provides a good case study. Interestingly, MRI scanning has played opposing roles, both increasing and decreasing surgery for these tumors. With the advent of MRI scanning in the 1980s and the ability to diagnose small and, in many cases, incidental schwannomas, surgery for these tumors significantly increased. In the last decade or so, however, this has been tempered by an increasing trend towards observation, especially given the ability of MRIs to accurately define growth rates and to do so without radiation exposure. An even greater impact on surgery, of course, has been stereotactic radiation, and the future role of chemotherapeutic agents remains to be defined. These trends are well demonstrated on this slide, which summarizes data from the ANS surveys of 1983, 1998, and 2008. Surgical treatment for newly diagnosed vestibular schwannomas has gone from 100% in 1983 to 60% in 2008, and probably closer to 50% today. Stereotactic radiation and observation accounted for 20% each of the treatments in 2008 and is estimated at 50% combined today. Well, let's consider for a moment some demographic data. There are approximately 3,200 new cases of vestibular schwannomas diagnosed each year in the United States. In the future, I think a conservative estimate for the percentage of cases that will receive stereotactic radiation is 35%. The current observation rate is 20%, but I will assume that only half of those will undergo long-term observation and not require some type of intervention. That leaves 55%, which will undergo primary surgery. And assuming that 5% of the radiation cases will subsequently need surgery, this would be an approximate 1,800 surgical cases available per year. So that's on the demand side of the equation. On the supply side, as it currently exists, 245 neurootologists are board certified, and 45 took the exam last month. So we could assume that there's about 290 neurootologists performing posterior or middle cranial fossa surgery. Now, I realize that not all of those 290 may, in fact, be doing that surgery, but there are many other neurootologists in practice who do that surgery and have simply elected not to be board certified. And this number does not include neurosurgeons operating on these tumors. So if we assume that 290 is a reasonable estimate, this averages to about 6 surgical cases per year per neurootologist. Now, for those surgeons who have practiced neurootology for several decades, these trends do not impact surgical skills. But for those who have begun practice more recently, is the number sufficient to acquire or maintain proficiency? Has the golden era of vestibular schwannoma surgery been eclipsed, like otosclerosis surgery was in the 1970s and early 1980s? We, of course, do not know the long-term consequences of stereotactic radiation, particularly as it relates to the development of malignancy, so it's possible that the pendulum may swing back towards microsurgery in the future. Technology has had the opposite effect on the treatment of sensory neural hearing loss. Although the application of implantable hearing aids is still in its early evolution, I think that the concept is sound and that we will see considerable progress over the next 10 to 15 years. With increasing sophistication of cochlear implants, their indications will significantly expand. The introduction of the hybrid devices will require more refined and precise surgery, which may in turn directly impact who is actually qualified to do that surgery. Both middle ear amplification devices and advancement in cochlear implant technology will likely result in more surgical opportunity for the neuro-otologist. This possibility, however, needs to be considered in the light of welcomed advances that will most likely be made in regenerative medicine and gene therapy. Will the code for hair cell regeneration finally be unlocked? Will we be able to deliver in utero necessary genes by viral vectors to reduce or eliminate some forms of genetic hearing loss? If nothing else, these two examples, vestibular schwannoma surgery and advanced treatment for hearing loss, emphasize the inherent difficulty of predicting future manpower needs. And we have not even touched on the implications of our aging population and the increasing pressures that it will place on both auditory and vestibular rehabilitation. Perhaps one day vestibular prostheses, as we heard in the latter part of the morning, will be as common as cochlear implants. Changes in practice patterns present another very powerful force impacting the future of our specialty. The most obvious case in point is Meniere's disease, where our approach has taken a dramatic turn towards medical rather than surgical intervention. Now, lastly, I need to touch on governmental and insurance mandates. We will continue to see a greater and greater emphasis on pay-for-performance and quality from all who underwrite healthcare costs. Outcome analyses will become increasingly available, empowering patients in their healthcare choices. Assuming that all this tracked data is accurate, this will be a good thing. That said, healthcare choice by the patient is one thing, but insurance or governmental suggested or coerced choice is quite another. This, for example, is from the United Healthcare website. This company has established centers of excellence for various medical conditions and offers reduced co-payments for patients accessing them. Although the concept is reasonable, true objectivity may be compromised by political and financial biases and simply by inaccurate data. Well, how do our fellowships prepare for the future? I would suggest that the fellowship directors, with input from other ANS members, collectively develop a white paper that attempts to address some of the future concerns that I've outlined and others that I have not discussed. Examples should include a greater emphasis on vestibular medicine and rehabilitation. Although not a glamorous area, perhaps it is important, nevertheless, if we wish to maintain ownership. A greater emphasis on hearing aid technology, both external and implantable, will also be important. More in-depth rotations in related disciplines, such as neurology and neuro-ophthalmology, could be considered. I believe that stereotactic radiation training should be an integral part of every fellowship, with certification being a goal. Changes to program requirements, of course, must be funneled through the proper channels of the RRC and the ABOTO. We should reappraise the research component of our fellowships to be sure that our graduates have the tools to compete. An in-depth basic science experience is ideal, but this is not always possible. If not, programs should provide focused studies in genetics, temporal bone histopathology and related areas, or in clinical trials, outcomes research, or health policy. Our training programs have a history of excellence, and as a result, neuro-otology has developed into a robust subspecialty, which in many ways is a leader in the broad field of otolaryngology head and neck surgery. I challenge the younger generation to maintain a high level of insight, discernment, and aggressiveness as changes in technology, science, and health policy bombard us. Developing a 10-year blueprint for the future will help assure the continued preeminence of our specialty. To do so would be a fitting tribute to Bill House, who I'm sure is very proud to bear the moniker of Father of Neuro-Otology. Let me conclude by quoting from this honor bestowed on him in 1995 by the Academy. William F. House, DDS, MD, by applying the surgical microscope and a detailed knowledge of the anatomy of the temporal bone. His contributions have been numerous and varied. He made practical the translabyrinthine approach for removal of acoustic tumors. He developed the middle cranial fossa approach for temporal bone surgery. He developed the first practical cochlear implant and courageously applied it to children. And then my emphasis, he has developed more new concepts in otology than almost any other single person in history. And that is amazing. Thank you very much.
That was truly an outstanding lecture. And in recognition of that, and on behalf of the Neurootology Society, I present Dr. Lambert with this plaque.
Thank you very much.